From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with many stories of high strangeness, followed by, of course, conversations with Linda. Also, welcome new affiliates to the ever-growing Coast to Coast family, WTRC AM and FM in South Bend, Elkhart, Indiana, WFPA AM in Huntsville, Alabama, and WAEW AM in Knoxville, Tennessee. Welcome to the program. By the way, within about a week, in addition to phone calls and fast blasts, you will be able to text me a question when we have our guests on and we're asking them questions from you. I'll give you that number in about a week or so, and you'll be able to send me a quick text, and we'll get it on when we're chatting with folks on the phone. Here's what's happening. As BP labored for a second day now to choke off the leak at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, dire new government estimates show that this disaster has easily eclipsed the Exxon Valdez as the biggest oil spill in U.S. history. After an 18-hour delay to assess its efforts and to bring in more materials, BP has now finally resumed pumping heavy drilling mud into the blown-out well 5,000 feet underwater. Officials said it could be late Friday, maybe the weekend, before the company knows if the procedure known as the top kill has cut off the oil that has been flowing for 5 weeks. As he's been watching this situation unfold since this disaster began, Captain Kelly Sweeney with us. Kelly, I don't want to say we told them so, but we did say this would be the biggest oil disaster in history, and it is.
Ahoy, George, and you know, we can tell them so. You and I were saying that almost from day one, and finally the truth came out that this spill is indeed officially, without a shadow of a doubt, as you pointed out, the worst oil spill in U.S. history.
They're saying the estimates of the oil flow into the Gulf much more than even BP is saying.
I agree. And at the lowballing is 2.5 times what they were saying. And by even the high estimates, it's 5 times, which would put it right now far beyond the Exxon Valdez, almost 4 times the Exxon Valdez. And, you know, George, on the top kill, they have indeed resumed that tonight. Now, a lot of people I was talking with today didn't really understand the overall procedure. And essentially what's happening is this. The heavy mud is basically a bentonite clay, barite, and other things mixed in to make it a heavy, thick mud.
Pasty, very pasty.
That's right. And it's pumped down, and they had 2 ships on there, and they had 2 million gallons of this for the initial start on 2 vessels. And they pumped it from one vessel to the other, which then pumped it down the pipe. And the idea was that the weight of this would be enough to offset the force of the oil coming up and leaking out. And for a while, it looked like it was working. And then later on in the day, the video showed that there was a mixture of oil and the heavy mud coming out of the leak. And now the problem is, and the difficulty that they have, is finding that balance between having enough of that heavy mud to stop the leak, but not having so much that the pressure of the oil coming up and the weight of the mud coming down, the pipe is already cracked and leaking. If it gets to the point where that's too much in there and the pressure is too great, it's going to crack that pipe even worse and make the leak even worse and cause themselves even greater problems. That's what's happening now, is that they're trying to find that balance, go slowly, and see where they can get enough to where they stop the leak but not have so much that they crack that pipe and make it much worse.
You know, Kelly, you know, you and I have been on top of this thing since it happened, and we've been right about everything we've been talking about. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think the only way we're going to be able to stop this is possibly just blowing it up down there.
Well, George, I'm sure that they've looked at that, and you know you're right. We have been... you and Coast to Coast are way ahead of everyone else. It's amazing. As I said this one of the first times I was on with this, and I've said it before when we were talking about the Maersk, Alabama, it's amazing how many times that you'll talk about something on Coast, and then, like, everybody else gets it a day or two later. And you're absolutely right. I'm sure they're looking at different options. Now, blowing it up, I don't know. I think that what they are going to continue on is going to be the drilling of the relief wells that they're doing, and those will definitely solve the problem, but they're months away. So if this doesn't work, everybody needs to keep their fingers crossed, at least till tomorrow, and then maybe, like you say, through the weekend. If this doesn't work, then I don't know what their next plan will be. They'll try another top hat, another containment dome. I don't know. Blowing it up, I mean, you're right. Their hands are they're tied. Their options are running out. But I know they're trying everything, and it's a very tough situation.
Okay, Kelly, and I want to congratulate you and really compliment you on the work you've been doing for us over the past month or so.
Well, George, it's a pleasure, and I appreciate you having me on, because if you and your producer, Tom, didn't facilitate this and have me on, the Coast listeners wouldn't get the information ahead of everybody else, and I appreciate it, and I really thank you for that as well.
Okay, Kelly. A new earthquake. That's what Haitian farm leader Chavanaz Jean-Baptiste of the Peasant Movement is saying. What is it? This is an incredible story. Back in January, Haiti was hit with a 7.0 earthquake. It devastated the country. The Monsanto Corporation wants to send them seeds in order to just grow, okay? The farmers don't want the seeds. They believe that the 60,000 seed packs are hybrid corn seeds and vegetable seeds. They're treated, they say, with highly toxic pesticides. They don't want anything to do with the genetically modified seeds that Monsanto wants to give them to grow crops. The farm leader is simply saying, we don't want this in the country. It's a strong attack on small agriculture, farmers, biodiversity, on Creole seeds, and we don't want it. It's an amazing story. The Atlantic storm season may be the most intense since 2005, when Hurricane Katrina killed over 1,000 people after crashing through the Gulf of Mexico energy facilities. In its first forecast of the storm season now that begins on Tuesday, here it comes, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is forecasting up to 23 named storms, up to 14 developing into hurricanes, nearly matching the 2005 record. 3 to 7 of them, they say, could be at least a Category 3 or higher. Mitch Batras, who heads up the EarthChangesMedia.com website. Mitch, do they really know what's going to happen?
Well, they don't know for sure. It's still an unpredictable to a greater degree. Not like earthquakes, where that's much less predictable. But they do have a pretty good average on trends, and I believe NOAA is giving it a 70% chance of their analogy that you just read. I would agree with that. I would say that what they call El Nino, La Nina, and these warm, hot, and cold jet streams and ocean currents does seem to have a setup for a significant hurricane period. Now, needless to say, if that occurs, especially within the next few weeks, depending on how the BP oil spill goes in the Gulf of Mexico, could be absolutely disastrous. It already is. This would make things so much worse.
Hey, Mitch, contact Lisa, and let's get together and do a full show as we get close to the season, okay?
That'd be great.
Great, thanks. Mitch Batras, his website, earthchangesmedia.com, will be part of our Twitter feed, coasttocoastam.com. The Electronic Frontier Foundation says that more is needed from Facebook to address privacy criticisms. In a blog post, the Civil Liberties Group praised Facebook for a great first step, they say, towards giving members of the site more control over their data. However, it warned members against choosing the site's recommended privacy control settings. Doing that shares a substantial amount of information all over the place. Now, if you're a parent, listen to this one. Schools in several states, including New York, Texas, Florida, and Massachusetts, have blacklisted silly bands. These stretchy, colorful bracelets that are creeping up the forearms of school kids across the country, retail for about $5 for a pack of 24. Why are they upset with these things? Because students fiddle with them during class, arrange, swap them, trade them, and they don't pay attention while they're in the classrooms, according to the teachers. So these states are just banning this little rubber band thing. Former child star Gary Coleman has been hospitalized in critical condition. Coleman was taken to a Utah Valley Regional Medical Center in Provo. He apparently fell at home and hit his head. He's 42. Coleman is best known for starring as Arnold Drummond in the late 70s and early 80s sitcom Different Strokes. His frequently uttered, "What you talking about, Willis?" directed at his older brother, played by Todd Bridges, became a catchphrase. Coleman has struggled in recent years, afflicted with kidney disease, the reason for his short stature, his long health problems. He's been hospitalized. In February, he had a seizure on the set of a TV show. He has had money problems. He sued his parents over mismanagement of his finances. Gary Coleman, in critical condition. He's 42. In one of the most common forms of arthritis, it's on the rise among women in the U.S. Rheumatoid arthritis is going up, not down. It's going down for men, but it's going up for women. Stocks, a little turnaround, jumping 285 points. Mortgage rates are back near record lows. Turmoil in the stock market and the European debt causing American homeowners to ease up a little bit. Mortgage rates are inching closer to a record low. That brings in Catherine Austin Fitz for a bit. Is this good news for us or bad, Catherine?
Well, it's a little bit of good coming out of something bad. You have turmoil in the markets. And as you said, George, money's leaving the euro and leaving the stock market, and it's looking for a safe haven. And what investors want is U.S. government debt, and they can get a little bit more yield if they go into mortgage securities. What we've seen happen over the last 3 years, it's been happening for a while, but it's really accelerated. In the first quarter of this year, 91% of the mortgages in this country had a government guarantee on them. So we have a lot of the volume going through Freddie, Fannie, FHA, Ginnie Mae. It's all government guaranteed. And so it's a natural place when investors are looking for a safe haven to come, and that's pushing the rates down on mortgages, which for many people is a blessing because they're able to really lower their interest costs. And, you know, this is great savings. The sad thing about this, George, is the people who most need some relief on their mortgages because their homes are now worth so much less than the mortgage or their incomes have fallen, can't refinance and get the benefit of it. But there are many who can, and the mortgage brokers are reporting just tremendous interest. So hopefully this will be a chance for people to get some real relief on the household budget.
Very good. Thanks, Catherine. Catherine Austin Fitz, her website, too, will be part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment. He's an author, Pet Ghosts, Animal Encounters from Beyond the Grave. He's been on radio programs such as Coast to Coast AM. He's been on TV shows, and he's a paranormal investigator. And his name is Joshua P. Warren. Joshua, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, doing great. Thank you, George. Wonderful to be on the program. And indeed, you know, one reason I wanted to talk tonight about the controversial subject of ectoplasm. Well, recently, you know, the Lemur team and I have been on the National Geographic Channel and the Discovery
Channel. You sure have, and you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much, George. We've been really focusing a lot on plasma. You know, we've taken crews into our laboratory and explained how the plasmas might be this medium by which ghosts materialize. And what I find intriguing is that a lot of people continue to contact me, and they are confused about the difference between plasma and ectoplasm.
Okay, explain.
Well, you know, plasma is not controversial. Plasma is a state of matter, just like liquid or solid or gas. It's the fourth state of matter. And something like a lightning bolt is a plasma. A candle flame is a plasma. The sun is a plasma. In fact, most of the known universe exists in a plasma state. Ectoplasm, on the other hand, is very complicated and controversial, and it's considered to be one of those areas of, you know, pseudoscientific study.
Some scientists say it exists, others say no way, right?
Well, that's true, because there has been a lack of good analysis done, and tonight I want to tell you a story that I've never revealed on the radio before because it sounds so unbelievable, and that's quite a statement coming from me, I guess. And I also want to sort of eventually ask people to help me with some research into ectoplasm. I've become very interested in this because ectoplasm has not been properly measured. The idea here is that sometimes psychic energy will actually manifest into some kind of physical substance, and that substance is a reflection of the kind of energy there that's sort of teetering on that boundary between the physical and non-physical. It's almost like a byproduct. So, for example, at very haunted places, you hear stories about this kind of nasty, disgusting, slimy ooze that will kind of drip down walls. And it's considered to possibly be an expression of some kind of very negative, diseased, dark energy that is congealing into this sort of amorphous, almost cancerous-like formation. But in other cases, we actually have a very well-designed, very stable, sort of solid sort of object that will just materialize and drop out of the sky or in the middle of the room. And so you have these two different extreme examples. Now, I must tell you that obviously the idea behind ectoplasm was first kind of popularized and abused by some of these scam artists who were, of course, Victorian psychics. And they would have, you know, cheese cloth that was dipped in something like flour and water, and they would pull it out of a nostril.
Puff, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, come out of an ear. And it was meant to sort of shock people and make them turn away, which is always a good thing when you're a scam artist, to have people turn away from you. And in fact, last October, you may recall, I had a fellow named Zeke, the magician, come to Asheville and put on one of those old Victorian seance dinners. And he, you know, used the ectoplasm effect, and you can see why that it was very disturbing.
Well, he was a good magician.
Yeah, he was. He was a very good magician. And there were people who attended that dinner who were angry a little bit afterward when they realized that it was all fake. That was how convincing it was to them, and I took for granted they would realize that, but no, he was very good. But now when it comes to the reality of seeing these things, right now Lex has got an image posted at coasttocoastam.com that I sent of what may be an ectoplasm that I actually was able to videotape. This was when I was at Myrtle's Plantation down in Louisiana. A lot of people consider it the most haunted mansion in the world, mm-hmm. at least the country. And there is one room, the General David Bradford suite, that has most of the activity. And what I found was that when I looked at the floor with my naked eyes, I could not see anything unusual. But when I looked at the floor using the infrared function on my video camera, well, as you can see in this image there on the website, suddenly I could see this kind of disgusting ooze that almost looked like bloody footprints. I don't know how visible that is in the image you have, that would continue to sort of appear and manifest at this one spot where people continually see the apparition of a murdered man. So I have taken some samples of that, and I'm having them tested, and we'll let you know when those results come back.
Does the ectoplasm seem to be under intelligent control?
You know, that's a great question, because most of the time when you have this kind of slimy ooze, it does not seem to be. It seems like something that is almost, in a weird way, like an infection of the environment. But the most intriguing part of this is what happens when it does seem to be under extremely intelligent control, which leads us to the story I want to tell you. And I'm really interested in getting your feedback and the feedback.
Okay, well, let's do that after the break, if you can, Joshua. And I wanted to get your real quick reaction. Would you pay $1.15 million for the house, the Amityville Horror House?
You know, it is tempting. It really is. I mean, I do know that the story of the Amityville Horror has been highly sensationalized. You know, Jay Hansen, the writer, added a lot of elaborate details, and it's difficult to separate fact from fiction. But the bottom line is, there is no doubt that a whole family was brutally murdered in that house in 1974. And I have to believe that there is some real paranormal activity within, and it would probably be a gold mine for a researcher, and yet it's also, you know, very morbid. I mean, some people have a problem with
Josh, I got to tell you, I wouldn't pay $50,000 for it. No way. Don't want anything to do with it. We'll hear your story when we come back, and we'll take some paranormal phone calls from you with Joshua P. Warren in just a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with four incredible stories throughout the night, including then conversations with Linda to wrap up the program. And when we come back, we'll take some phone calls with the paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren as we discuss ectoplasm on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Josh, before we take some phone calls with you, what's that story you wanted to share?
Well, you know, George, this goes back to the question you were asking about whether or not these are random substances, these ectoplasms and psychic materializations, or if they have maybe some intelligence behind them. And, you know, for years I've been researching the virtual wishing machine. I've talked about it here on the show, and this is a printed design. You write a wish in it, and oftentimes it'll come true. And the idea is that a mental thought form somehow takes on physical existence, and I've experimented with thousands of people, and I think there's a relationship here. In fact, since I don't know when I'll be back on Coast, I'll go ahead and announce that I have created a brand new wishing machine workbook, and I've got that on my website, joshuapwarren.com. There's no period after the P at joshuapwarren.com, and I'll sign it for anybody who wants it. I'll throw in a free pamphlet about how to make wands for people who get that as well, because there's a lot of interest, and much of this stemmed from an experience I had in Washington, D.C. at the Jefferson Memorial in 2002. Now, mind you, I've never talked about this on the radio, and I'm hoping that I can get some feedback that will be helpful.
Sure.
I was there just months after 9/11. In fact, I happened to be in New York just right before 9/11, and then I was in D.C. right afterward. And at that point in time, D.C. was kind of like a ghost town. I mean, there was just nothing. I guess people were afraid. They were paranoid. Very few tourists were there.
They were in shock.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my wife had never been there before. And so on a late night, I guess it was about 10 o'clock at night on a Wednesday, we decided to go to the Jefferson Memorial. Now, of course, Washington, D.C. is understandably one of the most haunted places in the world. And a lot of people had told me that they had actually seen what they believed to be Thomas Jefferson's ghost hanging out late at night around this memorial. And so I said, oh, we've got to go there late. So when you walk into this memorial, it's just a big, huge stone dome. And standing right in the middle of it, very majestically, is this tall statue of Jefferson, and that's it. If you can imagine the layout here, it's just a dome with a statue standing in the middle underneath it. There are no shelves or anything like that. And in the background, you know, you have some historic text that's carved. And so my wife and I were the only two people there. And there was this sort of quiet, shrine-like atmosphere. And as we stood there, gazing around, soaking in this incredible sight, all of a sudden, a pink rose literally dropped at my feet. And my wife was standing right next to me, and we looked up and said, where in the heck did that come from? It actually sent a chill down my spine, because we looked at each other and we realized, we both saw it. It just appeared and dropped there, and I didn't even want to touch it. I know that sounds weird for a guy like me who's a researcher, but there was something so peculiar and so eerie.
A message?
Well, you know what? I took pictures of this rose. And in fact, I've got pictures on my website of this rose, as well as some other strange anomalies that were appearing that night around the Jefferson Memorial. And after that, now this is the only time I in my entire life have actually more or less seen an object materialize and fall. So I started researching Thomas Jefferson to see what could the meaning possibly be here. And what I found was that Jefferson had some affiliations with the Rosicrucians, which was a secret society. And I still don't know a lot about the Rosicrucians, not being one myself, but it was related to Freemasonry and some of the early Christian mysticism. And some of the discussions that would be held in secret would be held standing under a rose, hence the phrase sub rosa. So if you had a conversation under a rose, it was meant to be kept private. But Jefferson apparently specifically would grow pink roses at his garden there at Monticello. And it's also apparently been understood throughout history that offering someone a pink rose is a sign of friendship and admiration. Now, that's as far as I can interpret this, but if there is anybody out there who has had a similar experience or who can offer more insight onto what happened to me that night at the Jefferson Memorial, not only would I like to hear from them, but if anybody out there believes that they have actual ectoplasm and they want to possibly have it tested, email me through the website. Now, trust me, I don't want people blowing their nose in a Kleenex and putting it in a Ziploc bag and sending it to me. So I am going to do the proper checking here to make sure this is a legitimate situation.
Welcome to the world of radio.
Yeah.
Hey, look, Jefferson died 184 years ago. Why is he hanging around in some form or fashion?
Well, you know, that's always the big question when it comes to ghosts in general. And what, you know, if indeed this was a gift from Jefferson, then it indicates a conscious awareness. And I would say that even though he loved being at his home there in Monticello, there is such a majesty about that memorial that, I mean, I highly recommend it to any American, you know, to go there and experience the place that reveres the man who authored the Declaration of Independence for the most part. That I think that would be one area that more people than any other would go to visit if they were interested in Jefferson, because Washington, D.C. just has so many sites in general. I know a lot more people who have been to Washington, D.C. and to the memorial than have been to Monticello, so I can only imagine that that might be a place that he would frequent because it's a great point of contact for those who find what he did admirable.
Fascinating. Okay, to the phones we go to wrap up the hour with Joshua P. Warren, east of the Rockies in Porter, Texas. Lewis, you're on Coast to Coast. Hello, Lewis.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on the air.
Mm-hmm.
In May of 2006, me and my wife spent 5 days at a Myrtle's plantation, and we stayed on, it was the only room on the first floor, the General Bradford suite, the sitting room, bathroom, and the bedroom. We had several experiences there. We were kind of non-believers over anything paranormal until that week. It was very, very interesting. We heard more than we saw. And we weren't there 30 minutes, and we were sitting on the back veranda, the back porch, but the door goes into the Bradford suite. And we're sitting there. We just put our bags inside, and we heard horses. It sounded like a couple horses bringing a carriage up. We walked off the porch, looked around, nothing was there. And later we found out that, you know, that was a common occurrence. And 2 days later, after we ate at the Carriage House restaurant right across the courtyard, there's a trail around the back. Supposedly, you know, you go back there and you see a Civil War soldier. So we went back there. In the process of walking back there, it sounded like a train was going by. It got so loud, me and my wife couldn't even talk to ourselves. We went back, and the next day we found out there hadn't been train tracks back there in over 100 years.
All right, how do you explain that, Josh?
Well, you know, Lewis, that is a great call, because everything that you said fits right in with my experience there. I stayed in that exact same room, the General David Bradford suite. That is the place that could change your life and change your mind about the paranormal. In fact, and I've talked about this before, but I'll mention it again, because I have this picture of this ectoplasm from that room, or what appears to be, I also posted there on my website at joshuapwarren.com a video that's about 10 minutes long showing you me in that room with some type of invisible force that is knocking on the walls whenever I ask it to. Now, I was staying there alone that night. In fact, the video is called Alone in America's Most Haunted Bedroom. And this thing was knocking on the walls whenever I asked it to. And this went on for hours and hours until finally I was trying to go to sleep and it was banging on the headboard right next to my head. That's when I realized just how far, you know, I could tolerate some type of ghostly encounter. I made up my mind. I must say that if I woke up and there was an apparition standing over the bed, I was sleeping in the car. But that was a life-changing experience for me.
Creepy place.
Very creepy, because it's one thing to consider that a ghost could be some type of imprint from the past or something residual. It's another thing when it seems to obviously have awareness and consciousness and is interacting with you. And that is what happened to me so clearly, so undeniably. And I was able to videotape majority of this, mind you. I mean, I had a video camera running. That it's unnerving when you get the impression all of a sudden that you're in a room and you believe 100% there is something in that room with you, but you cannot see it. And it undermines everything that we believe about our own personal security, and it makes us feel very small on the food chain. And this is ultimately why we are afraid of ghosts.
We've got to Steve in West Point, New York, on the wild card line. Steve, welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Joshua, I wasn't sure if you'd ever done any extensive reporting or any reporting at all about any paranormal activity at the United States Military Academy at West Point. And if not, I had a quick story I'd like to
share.
Yeah,
tell us the story, Steve. Go ahead.
Sure, sure. I actually involved two of my coworkers. One was named Pete, and the other one was Pat. Pete is a former Delta Force soldier, and Pat has an extensive background in law enforcement and security operations. And there's a couple dorm rooms in particular that are haunted, supposedly, at the academy. There's several different barracks for cadets to stay. This particular room has a sign on it that says, please do not leave any type of media, i.e. newspapers, magazines, etc., because the ghosts can't read. So they decided to investigate this room one night, and they went in, you know, just all, you know, ho-hum, not expecting anything. And they walked in the room, and everything was pretty much set up like it was just left. A bed was made, there was a desk, etc. You know, like your typical college dorm room. And Pete picked up a book on the desk, and it said receipt ledger. And he opened it, and Pat happened to be standing behind him, looking over his shoulder, reading the receipt ledger and looking over. And all of a sudden, the book was ripped out of Pete's hand and thrown across the room. Now, both men, I hold their word as their bond. I believe that their integrity and whatnot. They looked at each other, very frightened. The color ran out of both of their faces, and they both turned and didn't run, but slowly walked out of the room. So that's one particular story. I wasn't sure if Joshua had any other stories or knew of any other incidents at the United States Military Academy.
Anything there, Joshua, for you?
Hey, thanks for that account, Steve. You know, I have heard for years similar stories about that place. I have never had the opportunity to go there and investigate. That's always one of those tricky things to do at, you know, an active academy or anything to do with the military is always sort of tricky. And that's one of the problems that we have when it comes to looking into stories involving the military, because you start sounding very paranoid and conspiratorial when you point out examples of how and why military people are interested in paranormal activity. And I've always been told that a lot of the cadets there at West Point, they experience ghostly phenomena for the first time, and then they go on, and they become more interested and obsessed with the paranormal, and it opens their minds to exploring other potential for weaponization, even though, as Colonel John Alexander one time told me, you know, it's the Department of Defense, not the Department of Investigating Weird Things, but there is a connection there. And interestingly enough, I have been told anecdotally, and I cannot determine whether or not this is true, that some parties in the military are actually interested in ectoplasm and the manifestation of objects at paranormal locations because it might hold a clue as to how teleportation can be achieved when you're looking into non-locality. Because if indeed we're talking about an object that is manifesting between dimensions or realms, that really is not a far cry from us trying to instantly travel from one point to another in the universe. And one interesting example I'll throw out there when it comes to maybe understanding how this works is that I was the other day was reading a scientist, and he was talking about how if you have a fish tank and there is a single fish in the tank and you have a camera pointed at the fish from one side, and then you have a second camera pointed at the fish from another side, which is perpendicular. So, for example, one camera is on the front and one is on the side. If you're just looking at two monitors, you might get the impression you're looking at two fish. But you'll notice that whenever one fish on one monitor moves, instantaneously, the fish on the other monitor moves. And you can't figure out how the information is traveling from one fish to the other. But in fact, all you're doing is looking at two very different and extreme perspectives of the same thing. And that might hold the key as to how a lot of these ghostly manifestations occur, whether we're talking about ectoplasm or an apparition itself. We are talking about an energy that we are able to view a portion of and not all of. And until we're able to figure out how to look at it from more than one perspective, we're always going to be confused by seeing these fragments of the paranormal.
Joshua, how long does ectoplasm hang around? How before it dissipates?
Usually, it's just a few days. In some cases, it's been reported for weeks or months.
Really? That long?
Yeah, well, you know, you brought up the Amityville Horror, for example. And in that book by Jay Anson, and again, it's hard for us to determine fact from fiction, I believe they talked about, you know, for weeks, this green, slimy substance sort of dripping and shimmering down the hallways, as well as a black fluid that would appear in the bathroom. And but there's never been proper analysis done of these things. And it's because it's not very easy to collect a good, reliable sample and find somebody who wants to take a look at it in its fresh form. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to do. There might be something significant about the molecular structure of this substance that shows us how the non-physical energy has transformed into this other byproduct, into this other medium. And if we can find that there actually is something truly unique about the molecular structure of so-called ectoplasm, then it might be the first proof of a physical part of ghostly activity.
Let's grab a quick call, Anthony in Brooklyn, New York. Anthony, go ahead.
Hey, this is a quick question for the guest.
Sure.
I just wanted to know exactly, like, the places at Amityville Horror and, like, you know, the mansions and whatnot. Like, how do you set it up? How do you just say, you know what, I'm going to go down, spend the night in the in the haunted room? Like, how do you do this?
Well, there are some places that you are allowed to do that. You obviously can't go to a place that's private. But, Josh, how do you find the public places?
Well, you know, the Internet is the best resource that we've ever had. The reason that we have this big boon in ghost hunting right now is in part because that people are so easily able to communicate and hook each other up. And, you know, there are all kinds of discussion boards and websites that will give you access. But indeed, some of the best haunted places are private locations, and it is next to impossible to get in there. I am fortunate because due to, you know, being an investigator and being in the media on programs like Coast to Coast AM, people will contact me. Most of the emails that I get from people regarding haunted places are about private houses, and people will contact me and ask me if I would like to do an investigation, because generally the owners of such a spot are curious. And then when, you know, when you go in there, sometimes you can talk about it afterward and sometimes you cannot. But I would definitely say that, you know, if you go to any of the websites that are connected with my name or anything in your area, it's very easy to do a search, and you'll find some places that are a little more open than others, at least for a limited period of time.
All right, Joshua, my friend, stay in touch with us. Joshua P. Warren, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back in just a moment, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us for stories of high strangeness. Get ready.